Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Open Book, your weekly spiritual book club. I'm Lori Strawn, and with me, as always, is my good friend and boon companion, Alice Shelton. Hi, Alice.
Did you say your womb companion?
Boon companion.
Boon, good, very good. Well, it's great to be here with you. Lori, you're a gem.
Well, fans of the show know that we definitely have a few favorite authors that we return to again and again. And today is one of those days. We'll be taking quotations from Annie Dillard's book, Teaching a Stone to Talk, which is a collection of short stories. Here is our first quotation. God does not demand that we give up our personal dignity, that we throw in our lot with random people, that we lose ourselves and turn from all that is not Him. God needs nothing, asks nothing, and demands nothing, like the stars. It is a life with God which demands these things. You do not have to sit outside in the dark. If, however, you want to look at the stars, you will find the darkness a necessity. But the stars neither require nor demand it. What do you think about this quotation, Alice? Do you think, first of all, that knowing God demands us that we give up our personal dignity, throw in our lot with random people, lose ourselves, the kind of thing she says? And then what do you think about God not particularly caring one way or other?
Well, I kind of had to read and reread this because I don't think that God asks that we give up our dignity, that we're with random people. I mean, I think God asks us to be with people. I don't know that I'd say random. I definitely don't think we lose ourselves in the sense, in a negative sense. But I do think God asks that we turn from all that is not Him. But that, I don't think that has anything to do with dignity or and is there loss in it? Yeah, I think there's loss in it, and I think there's choice in it, and there's hard stuff in it. But I don't. Yeah, I guess I just don't think it's dignity was an odd phrase there for me. Did you think so?
Actually, I'm okay with that word. In that, it's more like we're giving up our egos. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah.
You have to stop caring about how you look in front of other people. You have to be open to people that you might ordinarily not want to be open to. You know? It requires, being close to God requires being close to people. And people can be messy and difficult and frail and all sorts of things. So I get that. What I didn't like about the quotation was, I do think God longs for us to be close to God. You know?
I do too.
That God made us for that reason.
Yeah, and I think that longing is a lot of what describes inside ourselves, and I think we share that with God. I think God does not need us. But, you know, I'm going to have to think about whether I think we need God in terms of inherently in our creation, or if God created us so much like God's self that we don't need God, but God longs for us to want Him. It's a choice, I guess, is my point, you know? But
yes.
I do think there's some natural, there's something in me that does long for God.
Yeah.
Now, I had to get to be this age to quite kind of get that. So I didn't identify it as that all my life, but I think it's probably good that we had this talk about this quotation because I was really responding to the words Anne used, and your explanation of the way you perceived it helped me understand it and agree more with what she's saying about the whole thing about random people and dignity. So
okay.
I wasn't thinking of dignity as ego, so that was helpful.
Okay. Well, let's move on. The author describes an intense encounter she has with a wild creature, a weasel. She writes, I don't think I can learn from a wild animal how to live in particular, but I might learn something of mindlessness, something of the purity of living in the physical senses and the dignity of living without bias or motive. I would like to live as I should, as the weasel lives as he should. What do you think about that, what she's talking about intention? Do animals live in some sort of way that we ought to emulate?
Well, I think I crack up at her use of the weasel because I just think that's random, you know, of all animals I could pick. I think it's funny. But it's a good visual. I think what Dillard's saying here, what I understand her to be saying is, I think that animals have purposeful lives. They are not the same purpose as our lives. And, you know, when they go about doing what they're doing and what they're supposed to be doing, that's sort of them self-actualizing to their highest function and purpose. So I kind of get it from that standpoint that if we would emulate that more, we would not wish away time. We would not fear for the future. We would not worry about the past. We would not, you know, we sort of would go about, if we were a squirrel, finding our nuts, eating them, going to the next thing. And there's, we would not be overthinking things, I guess. We wouldn't be worrying about others' motivations. Yes, we would be largely out for ourselves, but not in a selfish way, in a kind of patterned and called way, which is, I think, for a human being would be responding to what God wants us to be.
Exactly, exactly. I feel the same way. In some ways, animals do live in a pure way in that it's their inborn instinct. They don't kill for sport. They don't discriminate based on random differences. Our friend Janine, she's a penguin keeper at the local wild animal park. She says same-sex penguin couples often adopt eggs that have been rejected by their mothers and try to hatch them themselves. Totally normal, totally accepted. The other penguins don't freak out.
Yeah.
I don't think we're as accepting as animals are in many ways. But it is
harder, I agree.
Yeah. I think it's harder, though, for us to live as God wants us to live because of all of that complex stuff happening in our heads. You know, it's hard enough to figure out how we ought to live, and then actually implementing that is just a whole other thing.
Well, it's not unlike, you know, I remember my mom talking when we were kids about part of the reason she liked school uniforms was that when you eliminate choice and you kind of make things the same, you eliminate certain things that are difficult. And I get that. I mean, I kind of wish there were adult uniforms. I kind of wish certain areas of life had really clear rules where you didn't, that was just it. You know, obedience is a big deal. But, yeah, and animals have that all the time.
True. True. Well, here's our next quotation. Within species, individuals have evolved immune reactions which help preserve individual integrity. You might reject my liver, or someday my brain. As much of the world's energy seems to be devoted to keeping us apart as was directed to bringing us to here in the first place. Do you agree with that? Why or why not?
I don't agree with it.
Nor do I.
I really don't. Is she talking about natural selection?
Yeah, partly.
When she's talking about within species, I mean, that's what I thought. You know, I don't think that has a whole lot to do with keeping us apart. I think it's, I think it's partly survival. I just don't agree with it. Can you articulate why you don't agree with it?
Well, I think that there's more evidence that we belong here together than that we belong apart. I mean, yes, not all species are compatible, but then again, you know, lions and tigers mate sometimes. Dogs and cats are friends. You know, you see strange things in nature all of the time. We were born among many, and to me that's a statement from God saying you've got a responsibility to this fact, to learn how to deal with other people in a healthy way.
Yes, other people and other species and other parts of creation. And I guess you and I have lived during a time where I think my science tells me that some of these things that we're describing as having evolved, particularly things now, to me, evolution is almost an untouched process. Human beings I mean, everything impacts evolution, of course, because the environment does, but we've created an awful lot of these things. So
right.
The world's energy being devoted to keeping us apart is our own energy, if there's mm-hmm. if you take it to its nth degree. And so I think that's fundamentally why I have trouble with what she's saying.
Yeah, that's a really brilliant point. I like that.
Brilliant, Lori. That is wonderful. First time you've called me brilliant on the show.
But I do think you're brilliant all the time.
Thanks, Lori.
Okay. Well, the author speaks of a moment of solitude that causes her to have a profound reaction, and this is it. I had to try to turn away. Holiness is a force, and like the others, can be resisted. It was given, but I didn't want to see it, God or no God. It was if God had said, I am here, but not as you have known me. This is the look of silence and of loneliness unendurable. It, too, has always been mine and now will be yours. I was not ready for a life of sorrow. Have you ever felt something like this before? How did it affect you? And do you agree that God's world includes unendurable loneliness?
Well, recently I have been thinking about just the concept of suffering in life. And so I guess there's a part of me that is more and more coming to terms with the reality of just the reality of suffering as a part of life for myself, for other people, and how you walk with people in that, which I think is the greatest call we have in life to one another, is to just kind of walk alongside. Now, we can't eradicate it, we can't fix it, we can't change it, but we can be present. And so from that standpoint, I kind of have had a moment like this where it's like I kind of get this whole living the way of the cross thing, which I think is what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't always going to be this way, I say to myself, but parts of it really are, and that is part of it. We're not meant to be blissfully happy all the time. So I think that's my response. What about you?
I like that response. You're right. There are those moments when you do feel that kind of extreme loneliness. But I think what sustains me in those moments is that I am never without God, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I may be lonely. I may feel that just tremendous, overwhelming feeling of loneliness in this world. But if I let mm-hmm. myself turn to God, then I know, okay, this is just human loneliness. It's
yep.
not real in a way, because God longs to be with us.
Yep. And I do think there's a faith approach to loneliness, and this is going to sound over-perfected, like I, you know, suffer in silence or whatever. I think it is hard, but I do think there is redemptive work to be done with it if you can be present to it and use it can be really a gift if you can use the other gifts that you've been given and the tools that you have. Like, for instance, profound loneliness for me can be a time of amazing writing.
Mm.
And it can be a time when I notice things. If I'm taking a walk and I'm feeling sad or lonesome, I notice things in nature that I don't notice at other times. So I try hard to pay attention to those things. I also think that loneliness and sadness and suffering can become almost a chosen habit for some people, because partly because that's just been the pattern of their life and they don't know anything else. But I don't know why else they would do it. But I have observed that in some individuals, and maybe it's an attention-seeking thing. I don't know.
Yeah, very true. Well, here's a little vignette. Once, many years ago, there was a child of 9 who loved Walter Milligan. One Saturday morning, she was walking in the neighborhood of her school. She walked and thought, the plain fact is, as I have heard so many times, that in several years' time, I will not love Walter Milligan. I will very probably marry someone else. I will be untrue. I will forget Walter Milligan. Deeply, unforgettably, she thought that if what they said about Walter Milligan was true, then the rest went with it, that she would one day like her sister, and that she would be glad she had taken piano lessons. She was standing at the curb waiting for the light to change. It was all she could do to remember not to get run over so that she would live to betray herself. For a series of connected notions presented themselves. If all these passions of mine are overturned, then what will become of me? Then what am I now? Alice, I really would love to have known who you were at age 9. What were your Walter Milligans of the time? What did you feel strongly about? How have you changed, and how do you think your 9-year-old self would perceive your adult self?
Okay, I have two, what I think are, one's funny story, one's kind of a poignant story about myself at 9, when I believe I would have been in 4th grade.
Yes.
This was a great memory. And I loved Walter Milligan. I'm going to just kind of incorporate that into my life. It was John McCauley for me. I just always loved John McCauley, but I would never marry him. Anyway, all the girls loved him. So I was in my second year at a new school, 1.5 years in a new school when I was in 4th grade. And my teacher's name was Mrs. Cottingham, and she was a very short woman. And anyway, a Catholic grade school, we were sitting in the little individual desks, and I, apparently, unbeknownst to myself, hummed to myself. And I really didn't realize, I guess I knew I was humming, but I was really thinking I was doing it so quietly that no one could hear it, or I was doing it inside my head. And my classmates apparently could hear it. And so I remember being told very clearly that I was to stop humming, that I was disrupting the classroom during quiet study. And I just remember being grief-struck by this and very upset by it. And even at that age, thinking, you have all this, you have students who are mad, you have students who are mean, you have students who are not paying attention, they're dumb, they're chewing gum, some of them don't bathe, and you're worried about the happy girl who's humming in your classroom shutting up. I mean, you know, as a 9-year-old, I thought of that. So I still can kind of feel, I was embarrassed, you know, I can still kind of feel that sting, but I can also feel that indignation. So that's one example of who I was at 9, probably very much the same, most of our friends would say. The other one is, I can remember I volunteered to, I don't know, somehow clean up the church after Mass during the weekends or something like that, because we lived within walking distance of church. And one of the things I was supposed to do was put the little Mass pamphlets, the book, Mass books, back in the little holders in the pews and kind of straighten things up. And I used to get so frustrated at the condition in which people left the church. I mean, they'd leave trash on the ground. Those books would not be well handled. You know, there'd be pages torn out. They'd be bent backwards. You know, it was just a mess. And I remember concocting this elaborate sermon that I was going to give to the entire parish if given the opportunity, about how people should be taking care of these missalettes. And, I mean, I would just, like, daydream about what I would say, and I was, again, so indignant, and it's, you know, I don't know if those are the types of Walter Milligan things, but I kind of see myself in both of those examples now as an adult.
Oh, that's hilarious. And, yes, I see you a little bit. But I also kind of see me at that age. I would have been sort of the same way.
Yeah, life is very black and white at that age, you know?
Yeah.
Very black and white.
Yeah, I was in a new school at the time, too. And I had braces, and I was sharing a room with my sister. And I was very passionate about cats, dolls, and writing, which is, you know, not that different from now. But I
pretty
was even
consistent.
Weirder then than I am now. I know
that's
it's hard
so
to believe.
Funny.
Even more
did you?
Because I was so into make-believe.
You're not weird, Lori. You might be eccentric, but you're not weird. Yeah. Well, I'm still into make-believe. I mean, I still daydream. I still, like, actively pursue daydreaming.
Yeah.
Making up
yeah.
stories.
All
you know, doesn't bother me a bit. You know,
you
here's a
you
question.
Do you betrayed that girl at all?
I would say that I never considered myself, and I do not now consider myself to be what others might term as a dreamer. I have always been pretty much 2 feet on the ground person. I mean, so from that standpoint, I don't. I feel like my life has been pretty much what I expected that it would be.
Hmm.
How about you?
No, not at all. I, for one thing, at that age, I would have been scandalized because, for one thing, I should have been a best-selling author by now. I was certain of it at age 9. I would be surprised that I had been married for so long, because I always said I was never going to get married. I'd be happy that I lived with a lot of cats, but
yeah.
I would not be real thrilled with the whole height weight situation. Although I would have been thrilled that I finally filled out a little bit.
The whole height weight situation. Oh, we women are something else, aren't we? Oh my gosh. Oh, I love it. I think it's interesting. I don't have a lot of childhood memories, and so it was interesting today to think about even remembering the two things that I remembered, and it kind of made me want to intentionally retrace some of that stuff. One thing I am conscious of that I can remember quite far back, I'm a person who has had a clear sense of many times in my life stepping into something or whatever situation began or ended or whatever, of being aware that from this point forward, nothing is going to be the same again. And I can name you 10, 12, 15 times in life where I had that sense. And I don't know if that's normal or not, or if other people have that or not. Yeah.
I don't think that that's an ordinary thing.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I remember sitting the night before John had quadruple bypass heart surgery, and obviously that's a pretty major event. But I can remember sitting there and thinking, nothing in my life is ever going to be the same again. And that's to say nothing. No, not nothing is going to be the same. But there have been big changes. That was definitely a big, you know, cluttered part of the journey of life. And I can remember a lot of other situations like that. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. I think I would.
Because I'm a drama queen.
Not at all. So not a drama queen. Oh, my gosh. I can't even deny that enough. I think I would be interested to hear my life story at age 9, like how I was going to meet people, you know, the whole story of how I was going to go to college and how I was going to meet you and we were going to have this show. Oh, I think the 9-year-old me would have loved that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think so, too. I think even the college me would love that. And by the way, I ran into Rhonda Height Smith last week. She said to tell you hi. Speaking of our good
cool.
buddies from our women's lit class. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
We did some cool. You and I both had some really cool experiences in college that I, at the time, would not have looked at as, you know, spiritually growthful things. But as I look back on them, that class would be one. They're just a bunch of them. But, yeah, we were very fortunate in that.
Yeah, sure were. Well, here's another quotation. Week after week, we witness the same miracle, that God is so mighty he can stifle his own laughter. Week after week, we witness the same miracle, that God, for reasons unfathomable, refrains from blowing our dancing bear act to smithereens. Week after week, Christ washes the disciples' dirty feet, handles their very toes, and repeats, it is all right, believe it or not, to be people. Who can believe it? What do you think about that?
I kind of like it. I think that she's talking about, is the dancing bear act like mass? The weekly reference is what makes me think of that, or is it just human life? I mean, it doesn't really matter, but
the goofiness, the way that we've kind of made a hash of things, you know, with war
yeah.
and environment and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I have always thought that the most gleeful thing will be for me hearing God laugh and knowing that God laughs. And having experiences of times when I think God has to be laughing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
sometimes I'll do something or I'll think something or something. I'll think, oh, my God, God has got to just be thinking, you blooming idiot. I'm just up here cracking up. What does it take? So
yeah.
I like – this is just a real – whimsical view of God to me, and I like it a lot. And I love that you know, God's just like, folks, it's okay to be human. I created you this way, which is part of, if I go back to the first quotation we talked about,
mm-hmm.
I think that's part of why I have a little bit of a ugh against it, because Lori, I think God wanted us to have fun and make mistakes and learn. I mean, if God had wanted us to be any way other than the way we are, I don't think God would have created us this way. I mean, I think God knows we have to learn things the hard way sometimes. I think that's part of it. That's part of God's creation. So let's stop suffering it so much. And just, that doesn't mean you have a free-for-all to do anything you want, but it means stop being so hard on yourself. I'm preaching to myself there, by the way.
Yes, you are, very much. Yeah, take a minute with that after the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See your counselor.
Well, in the title story, Dillard talks about a neighbor of hers who is, seriously, trying to teach a stone to speak. She comes to the conclusion that our duty to nature is simply to witness it. But what does witnessing really mean, Alice? What is the responsibility of witnessing?
Well, in some ways I could say that it's like the whole concept of when you go camping or something, or you go hiking, what do they say? Go in, you know, take only something and leave only your footprints. I don't know what the first part of it is, but, you know, be respectful, live in a way that's respectful of nature. But I also think witnessing it is going beyond just standing within a forest, if you will. I think I told you that I have been reading Psalm 139 quite a lot. My spiritual director's kind of had me on that. And it ends in talking about walking the ancient paths. And I've been trying to figure out what the heck that means in my life and what reference that is and all this stuff, and maybe I'm attaching way too much to it. But I think in this specific quotation, the ancient paths and honoring the ancient paths has to do with respecting the length of time that nature has existed and what it has withstood and witnessed. I mean, there's something to that. To living next to that and within it. That I think if it's not really powerful to us, I mean, I don't want to sound like Yul Gibbons granola guy here, but, you know, a lot of nature has existed and will exist well beyond human lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, and we just take it so for, I take it so for granted.
Yeah. 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 It's witnessing isn't just looking at something. I think that there's that kernel of accountability that's built into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that
we
overlook.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the Sisters of Providence describe it as care of creation, living in right relationship. Living in right relationship to me has, of course, has to do with human relationships, but it's so not limited to that.
Yeah.
It's about honoring and respecting and boy, if you really do it well, it's complicated and it's big.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, I can't think of a better place to end, so that's what we'll do. There is one more story in this collection that I want to discuss, but I'm going to save it, and we're going to read it in its entirety as our Christmas show, so you don't want to miss that. We are not going to be here next week, but we'll be here the week after that. So be sure to join us on December 23rd. Until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book.
Have a great week and happy Advent. Bye, Lori.
Bye.